Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Friday, August 22nd, 2014. It's just after 1630 UTC. Let's see. Once again, it's one of these late weeks, and it's just me, no Yvonne. So the usual caveats apply. If you're one of those folks who doesn't like solo shows, who doesn't like it when I just talk to myself for an hour, tune out now. Join us again next week. This time it's entirely my fault. I had various activities going on pretty much every evening this week, and so it was impossible to hook up with either Yvonne or a substitute co-host this week. And in fact, not only that, I'm actually taking a half day today on Friday, so that Friday morning, that it is now here in the Seattle area, I can put this together and get it out, and then I'm going to work from home some in the afternoon. Yeah, because like I just had no time. I considered a couple times, maybe I'll record something over lunch while I'm at work on my phone, or maybe, whatever. And Tuesday evening, I did have a little bit of time, but, other things were coming up. And then yesterday, I was on a drive with my wife. We were heading to a concert that we went to. But for about half an hour during that drive, she ranted about various things about the Ferguson situation. And I'm like, damn it, I should be recording this. But she doesn't like to be recorded for those things. I've invited her to like join me for the show a number of times, but she's like, no. I don't want I don't want to say these things in public where people know it's me saying it and blah blah blah. And I'm like, come on, your rants are entertaining and amusing and whatever. And she's just worried she'll come off bad. Of course, now she, expresses these views on a certain discussion group online that she participates in, but her notion there is that she's anonymous, or at least pseudo-anonymous, so that people won't actually recognize that it's her in real life. But, I don't know. Come on. Stand up and say what you want to say. So, anyway, I wish I'd been able to record that, because that I'm like on the drive to the concert, I could have done the show right then just by our recording our conversation, but no. Of course, I also didn't even think about it until 15 minutes into the conversation, and at that point, whatever. Anyway, I looked through things I'd been tweeting and things in the news and blah blah blah, and they're really primarily two things that occupied the majority of my attention in the last week. And one is, of course, Ferguson. And two are the developments with ISIS and the guy they beheaded and our involvement in Iraq in general. I suppose there are two other things sort of one other thing looming on the horizon. I'm looking, there a few news alerts this morning about additional things happening in the Ukraine. And of course, I also have tweeted a bit about, tomorrow's the Doctor Who premiere. But, whatever. I'm a geek. Anyway, let's start a little bit on Ferguson. And, since last week, there are a few developments. One, of course, we've had a little bit more about the guy who was shot, a little bit more about the officer involved. I added this in a note really quick when I was publishing last week's show. The revelations that there was a petty theft a few minutes earlier really are irrelevant. There are, however, disputes over the facts of what was actually going on at the moment the guy was shot. And that is potentially relevant. And unfortunately, the reality is we'll probably never actually know what really happened. So here's the bottom line, that it appears to be a number of witnesses from the community, including Michael Brown's friend, say that at the moment he was fatally shot, he had his hands up and was surrendering. Apparently, the story from the police side is going to be, although they, so far everything's sort of off the record, you know, secondhand, there's no official story yet, but apparently it's going to be that at the time he was shot, he was coming after the officer. And there is, you know, apparently both sides agree there was some sort of scuffle initially. But again, that's also irrelevant. The only thing that matters is what the situation was at the moment that the shooting occurred. And the there is forensic evidence, but it's in, it appears to be inconclusive. I mean, only one of... There are three autopsies. Only one of them has been released, and that's the one that was done for the family. But it's inconclusive. It is potentially consistent both with the guy having his hands up surrendering and the guy lunging after the officer and running towards him in some way. And I don't think we can look to the physical evidence deciding that. So it's going to be, you know, the officer saying one thing and these witnesses from the community saying another thing. And, you know, on sheer weight of numbers, you'd think, okay, well, but there are eight people in the community and against the one officer. And so, you know, aren't the eight people more likely to be right than the one? Maybe. But you also have to consider that pretty much everybody involved is somewhat an interested party in the outcome. There are no truly impartial observers. The biggest witness who had the most to say so far is Michael Brown's friend. And, you know, we don't know. You know, is he going to say the exact truth of what he saw, or is he going to color it somewhat in his and his friend's favor? And the community members who are there, you would think, okay, maybe they're not... really biased here, but given all of the polarization and outrage that we've seen over the last couple weeks, that's probably not a safe assumption either. So I don't think we're going to know the truth from the witnesses either. Now, you know, I always have a tendency in these things to split the difference somewhat, in that, you know, it may very well be that you were in a situation where maybe the guy was trying to surrender, but the police officer, because he had very recently been in a scuffle with that guy, heat of the moment, blah, 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 didn't recognize that for what it was. As opposed to an intentional, he's trying to surrender, I'm going to shoot him. I think that's actually relatively unlikely. And more likely that you've got, you know, a heat of the moment, confusion, bad training, and yes, racial bias going on, and you know, you result in something tragic. And again, this is where, you know, hey, body cams, you would help in these kinds of situations. Now, in the last week, I've read a number of things saying, you know, even in the places that do have body cams, there are a number of problems with actual implementation and the legality of how things work. One on implementation is that in heat of the moment situations, often all you get is, you know, sort of jostling, jiggling, unwatchable video that points at the ground and the sky and the side and everything but, you know, the direct action, because every, you know, because the guy's jumping around and moving and whatever, and so you don't actually get a clear view of what happens. You probably would get good audio even in that situation, but you know, there's it's still a lot of room for interpretation. Now, to some degree, I believe that's a technological problem, and that over time we can develop better technology for that sort of thing. But right now, the state of the art of that, I mean, I think you guys remember our listener Bruce when he was on the show and talking about the wearable cam that he had for life logging. Slightly different thing. It's not recording video. It's recording snapshots, whatever. But, you know, a good deal of the time, it catches things that aren't all that exciting, aren't the center of the action, and sometimes it'll get the right stuff. But if you're relying on this for sort of a permanent legal record of what's happening, the technology does have to be a bit better than the state of the art today. But I have no doubt it will get better. The other problem is apparently there's a lot of variation jurisdiction to jurisdiction on access to such recordings after the fact. But one of the themes that has come up is that, of course, when there is an incident, it becomes evidence. And there are a lot of rules on access to potential evidence that mean that it can't necessarily... it doesn't become a public document that the press can access and evaluate independently. It becomes something that, is accessible to the prosecutors and perhaps to the defense under very controlled circumstances. And so you don't necessarily get the transparency that you would like from these kinds of scenarios. Because, part of this is not just, there is value in arbitrating disputes when they happen, and somebody says, the police officer beat me, and the police officer says, no, I didn't, and pull out the video and you find out who's telling the truth. But there's also the question of, you'd ideally want to do auditing, where on a regular basis, on a routine basis, these things are looked at to identify things that are going well, things are not going well, things that are not going well, places for improvement. You'd want to do after action reports. Basically, whenever an incident occurred, you'd want to have even if there was no sort of criminal investigation, even if there was no abuse of power, you'd want to use these as something. Just like sports teams review the video of their games afterwards to look at places they could do better, you'd want to be doing the same kind of things with these. So there are a lot of developments that would need to occur to improve these things. But I still think it's a good direction to be going, and incidents like this show that. I was looking at some of the statistics. The Economist had some numbers on number of police-involved shootings in the U.S., and it's a little bit more than one a day nationwide. That's a decent number. And you can make all kinds of arguments on sort of, which ones are justified, which ones are not. But having this kind of evidence would help really determine that and help crack down on places where there is abuse. And it's undeniable based on statistics that have been put out that, first of all, there is abuse. I don't know what percentage it is, but there is abuse, and not just when people are killed, but also just when people are bullied, when people are treated unfairly, when the police are going above and beyond their proper duties. I think it's, just to be clear, it's probably also clear that the vast majority of policing in the United States is above board and they're doing what they should do, and they are, but there's an undercurrent of bad behavior that's definitely there. There'll always be some, but you want to work to minimize it, right? You want to keep the, you want to kick out the people who have a tendency to abuse their power as a police officer. And also, if you look at the statistics, it's undeniable that there certainly seems to be, let's put it this way, there are, you could argue this in various ways, but there seems to be strong evidence that given the same scenario in terms of what members of the public are doing, if you're African American, you're much more likely to have that become an incident with the police, have it prosecuted, have it whatever, I mean, we just have to look at nothing else, you know, all this drug war type stuff. Statistics, you know, when you actually look at them, show that, you know, the white community, you know, for instance, uses many drugs at a higher rate than the black community actually does. But if you look at arrests, prosecutions, it's disproportionately in the African-American community. And I don't have any of these stats in front of me, but I'm sure you can look them up. I've seen them before, and I may not remember the exact details. So, you know, please call me on it if I've got something wrong here. But I think that it has been shown a number of times that there is a bias effect going on here, that needs to be battled, frankly. And, you know, now, on most of the drug things, of course, my answer is, well, legalize it and don't worry about it. But it applies across the board to other crimes, too. And for serious violent crimes, you know, the answer, by the way, probably isn't let's be more lenient on the African Americans. It probably is, hey, let's do better at prosecuting these on the white side, too. But it depends on the type of crime. It depends on the thing. You know, many of these crimes just... Many of these situations probably don't deserve prosecution at all, because there are a lot of nonviolent crimes that we're talking about here. But we should be looking towards fairness and uniformity in the application of the law. There shouldn't be an inherent bias where if you belong to one group, you're much more likely to get in trouble. And if you belong to another group, you're much more likely to get away with it. That's no good. And we should be working on all kinds of levels to look to make that more uniform and more fairly applied. Now, moving on from that, then there's the insane, crazy response to all this. And Yvonne and I talked about this a little bit last week, but you know, it just continued for most of the last week, where the police response in Ferguson after this happened has been absolutely ridiculous on almost every level. I mean, okay, we talked last week about how, you know, the two kids who started this incident, quote unquote, did everything they possibly could wrong in the incident. The police officer asked them to move over. They didn't. You know, the police officer, they were belligerent with the police, basically. They were being confrontational. They were talking back. They were doing whatever. And, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, if a police officer is doing something unfair or unjust, that there's not a place for protest. But generally speaking, the place for protest is not at the time yelling at the police officer. You do what's necessary. You respect their authority. You do what they ask. And then if they did something wrong, you get a lawyer involved, you file a protest, you do whatever. But you don't get confrontation. Anyway, they did everything wrong. However, starting with the shooting itself, assuming there's any bit of truth whatsoever in the eyewitness accounts of the shooting, the officer used excessive force. He didn't need to shoot them. Or shoot at the guy and kill him. There were probably other alternatives available in that situation. But after that, one of the things that came out in the last 24 hours before I'm recording this, there was no incident report filed at all by the Ferguson police. There was no statement taken from Officer Wilson. It was Officer Wilson, right? Who did the shooting. They just, you know, took him off and did the thing. He was taken to the hospital. He was evaluated and released. There have been a lot of misinformation, whether, you know, he had a broken orbital bone or whatever. And no, he didn't. He had, whatever. Anyway, starting with that very thing, that they didn't immediately get a sworn statement from him on what happened, is number one. But then, okay, there was a little bit of looting. They left the body on the ground 4 hours too while they were investigating the scene. And you know, I understand you have to collect evidence from the scene, blah blah blah. That's part of normal procedures, but did they do it as quickly as they could? Did they take their time? I don't know, but it was, the public was certainly getting riled up by how long that took. And then there was a little bit of looting when they found out about, a few places were broken into, and then kaboom, the massive response. And then the massive response has continued for days and days and days. And they brought in the state police, but there were still the local guys were still on the ground and involved. It was just a coordination thing. And fundamentally, at a very basic level, the presence of these officers in that way escalated the situation out of control. All they had to do here would just say, we're going to do a limited response. If someone calls us and says their store is being broken into, we'll send an officer, we'll deal with that particular issue, and we'll move on. And if there are people protesting in the streets, we'll let them protest in the streets. And, if, somebody throws a bottle, somebody threw a bottle. It's not, we don't have to, point an automatic weapon at them because they threw a bottle, and for the most part, just back off, let the town mourn, let the town be mad for a little while, because, they have reason to be mad. And let it blow off. But no, instead, you bring in your armored personnel carrier. You have everybody in there with massive firearms. You freaking point them at the protesters when you're trying to get the protesters to move. I mean, it's bad enough having them there. That's inflammatory in and of itself. But I saw a number of comments on Twitter and elsewhere from people, in the military talking about how, part of their fundamental training is you never, ever, ever point a weapon at a person unless you intend to kill them. Period. You hold your gun, you have it there, you can be threatening, but you don't actually point it at the person unless you're ready to pull the trigger and you're ready to kill them. But these yahoos were going around pointing their guns at people. This is just stupid. This is just stupid. And that's the one thing that you saw time and time and time again in this whole situation, where the police overreacting, the police doing threatening actions that only serve to escalate the situation.
17 hours.
There were a number of reports of, obviously there was lots of tear gas. Some of that tear gas was at demonstrators that they'd asked to move. But there were reports of them going through neighborhoods, tossing tear gas into people's lawns. People sitting in their own front yard getting tear gassed. Small groups of two or three people on dispersing and on their way home being chased by police and tear gas thrown after them. Now, all the usual fog of war comments, lots of different people's viewpoints, whatever you see. But I think the common thing seems to be, look, there was all kinds of needless escalation here. Now, to be fair, there was provocation from the protesters and crowds as well. Even if you have the majority of the protesters being completely peaceful, whatever, all it takes is a few people acting out and to help escalate the situation. You add the one guy who threw the bottle back. There were reports of Molotov cocktails, although those are disputed whether they actually happened or not. And again, you have mixed reports on that, and it's unclear who to believe. By the way, I should mention, I retweeted a couple things about this. There are also a number of pictures taken of known agitators from various organizations who basically make it their business to go around the country trying to incite violence, and that just took this as an opportunity to go do that. And so apparently a lot of the times when there were sort of these actions that led to escalation from the protester side. It was these outside agitators, and even the police acknowledged when they did arrests, a very significant fraction of the people who were arrested were from out of town, from all over the country, and not from there. But anyway, in all of this situation, what was needed every single day of this thing was efforts to be transparent, provide information, and de-escalate. Try to, take the points of tension and defuse them. But instead, what you got was from some of these agitators, but also most significantly from the various police departments that were involved here, time after time after time, they just did exactly the wrong thing. If the goal was to de-escalate and defuse the situation and get back to normal as quickly as possible, time after time, they did exactly the choice that would make things worse. And that's not to say that there weren't scenarios. They mentioned there were a couple people shot. And one of the times when the police came in was actually to provide medical attention for one of the people who'd been shot, because it was one of the protesters had actually been shot by some other person or something along those lines. And okay, yeah, legitimate thing for the police to do, get in, get involved with that situation. But that seems to have been the odd, that wasn't the norm. There were a few of those situations. The norm seems to be where the police went in, the police were scared, the police were nervous, they didn't understand what was going on, they felt threatened. And I understand why they could have felt threatened in some of these situations, but they got defensive and overreacted. And the overreaction led to more overreaction and led to a spiral. It seems to have finally started to calm down the last couple of days. The last couple of days have been fairly calm there as we write this, but everybody's write this as I speak. But everybody seems to agree somewhat that, there are a few next steps here. There's the investigations that are going on into the initial incident. And if it comes back, for instance, and says, looks like the officer was justified. Looks like this was a legitimate killing. The officer was responding to an immediate threat, etc. That this whole thing could explode again. One other thing I'll mention before taking a break and moving on is that there are a number of reports about the media just being awful here. I did tune in CNN on a couple of occasions. And what did I usually see? Reporters talking to each other. There were a lot of things about, there were a few reporters arrested, which is bad. I admit that probably shouldn't have happened. There were reporters talking about themselves getting tear gassed. They were talking about how they, were doing in the situation and what they were seeing. And I understand they were being put into a press zone and weren't really often allowed to wander around talking to people. But come on now. I saw a number of complaints that I agree with about the reporters making the story about themselves. This is not about them. The best stuff I saw on Twitter was generally not from the reporters. There were a few reporters that were pretty good. They generally weren't the major network reporters, but there were a few reporters that were pretty good. But for the most part, was people from the local community that I found who I could follow and follow their own tweets. They were much more authentic, much more, exposing their own feelings about what was going on and on the spot. Hey, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. We're trying to do this. We're organizing that. We're running away because they're tear gassing us, whatever. And it seemed to, and you know, you have the usual caveats whenever you're doing that about you're getting these slices into what happens. And supposedly the jobs of reporters are to be able to look at a whole bunch of these slices and aggregate a picture of, okay, what's really going on. But I'm not sure the reporters were doing all that great a job at it for the most part. Again, with a few exceptions. And get it, and following these people who are actually on the ground, actually part of the community, not professional reporters, just people who got involved in the situation, seemed to, at least to me, be more useful. Now, I've seen less of that from, you know, the, you know, sort of pro Officer Wilson side of the community. I did hear a couple interviews with people. At one point I turned onto the BBC and they were having a roundtable discussion in Ferguson, but it was a few miles away from all this was happening at some diner, and every single person in their roundtable was white. And I don't know if they did another roundtable in the next hour for people in the black community or what, but it seemed absolutely ridiculous to me that that's the conversation they were having. And, you know, so they, you know, they got a lot of people saying, I don't understand why they're doing this. I understand that, okay, maybe there's a problem, but certainly they're exaggerating this. Why don't they just calm down? Blah, blah, blah. And they had nobody from the other side there to engage in that conversation. That might have been a very interesting conversation if you had people from throughout Ferguson in both communities and they were talking to each other and trying to understand where each other were coming from. That might have been interesting, but that's not what they had. And it's like, you got to be kidding me here. Anyway, we'll see if it blows up again once the investigations proceed, etc. And, you know, these investigations do take time, but you know, there's also, I suspect the bottom line is, no matter what, especially since it appears that we've allowed multiple days go by without taking an official statement from the officer involved. You know, there's been all of this additional context layered onto it by the things that have happened afterwards, that we will never really know what happened. You know, much like Yvonne and I talked about Trayvon Martin, you know, we'll never really know what happened on that day. And I think that's going to be the scenario here. You know, it's all going to come down into the end of people choosing who to believe. Do you believe the police officer or do you believe the community witnesses? It's one person's word against another. Or one person's word against eight, or whatever. But it's still, who do you believe is where it's going to come down to, and you're going to get the a split in the community over who they believe, and that's the worst possible situation for these things. Because that just exacerbates the splits that exist in the community. It doesn't provide any, okay, look at this, here's what really happened, that can help diffuse some of these situations. Yeah, we'll see. It's all a shame. And again, one of the things we should always do on these things is also back up a little bit. And I've been just as guilty. I've spent the last half hour talking about this specific situation, but this is where it's actually really helpful to look at, you know, nationwide trends, statistics, look at things from a high-level viewpoint so you're not obsessed over the specific situation of this case, because you'll never know exactly what happened in this case, and you'll never know what was really in that officer's head. And, you know, did he shoot him because he was black? Did he shoot him because he was scared? Did he shoot him because he was scared, but he was scared because the guy was black? Yeah, or was it completely and totally justified, and it would have happened no matter what if the guy was white too? We will never ever know that. However, you can look at the statistical analysis to see, you know, is there an overall bias problem in the criminal justice system, and then you can start to work on that. So it is important to back up and look at the higher level situation, because that's something where you actually can gather evidence and you can look at things in aggregate and determine, you know, not on an individual, did this officer do something wrong point of view, but do we have a systemic problem? And if we have a systemic problem, which I think the evidence does support, how do we deal with that? On a not just a today basis, but on a how do we adjust attitudes and institutions to try to minimize these problems in the future? And that's a hard problem. I don't know the answer, but at least at that level, where you're not obsessed with the specifics of a situation and the emotional impact of a specific situation, you can evaluate the higher level problem and start trying to attack it. Anyway, we're going to take a break, and I'll be back, and I guess probably spend most of the rest of the show, if not the rest of the show, talking about Iraq and ISIS and all of that kind of stuff. Back after this.
This is a break, oh yes, this is a break. This is a break, cause no one gave me any suggestions. I told you, I warned you. So this is a break, this is a wonderful break. A wonderful break, yes indeed, this is a break. This is a break in the middle of Curmudgeon's Corner. Yes, this is a break, yes, yes. This is a break, 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 break. Yes, 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 this is a break. Yes, this is a break, 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 break. Break. Yes, it is a break. And now, and now, and now, and now the break is over.
And we're back. That took a little while. Hey, before I get on to the ISIS stuff, I just wanted to mention, you know, I said that we went to a concert last night. It was a Yes concert, the band from the 70s and 80s. They're still around. And Brandy's a big fan. I didn't recognize a single song, but whatever. It was fun, though. But afterwards, it was at one of the local casinos on an Indian reservation. And after the concert, we stopped by and we went in for a few minutes and, we had something to eat. All the real restaurants either didn't have vegetarian food that Brandy could eat or were closed already. So it was just a little place where you could get, you know, crappy nachos or burgers or whatever, but we had one of those. And, you know, we spent a little bit of time and you know, we did do the little thing with the slot machines for a little bit. You know, we walked in with $10 in cash and we walked out with $30 in cash. So not bad, but, just like my philosophy on the lottery is you spend a very small amount of money just for the fun of doing it. But, you know, it's completely mathematically illiterate to actually play to win because they're designed so that you lose. Just a little secret there. And with all kinds of psychological tricks to make you keep going anyway. It's really evil, actually. But anyway, it was fun. We did, like I said, $10 somehow, got lucky, came out with 30. But, the one thing I actually wanted to mention about that, though, has nothing to do with the slot machines. It has to do with this trip into the casino where we spent maybe 45 minutes to an hour max. The first time I can remember in like forever that I've been in an inside space where smoking was allowed. And I'm particularly sensitive to this. I've got asthma, and I've always been sensitive anyway. So by the end of our hour in there, my eyes were watering. My chest was tight. It took probably an hour after we left before I started to feel somewhat normal again. But I was like, I can't believe this. This is horrible. This is awful. And I know that, pretty much smoking indoors has been eliminated from public life in the United States. And I had forgotten how bad it was. And, on the one hand, I'm against, this really should be private people deciding what to do with their own interior space, but I'm grateful for anti-smoking laws, inside. I don't think smoking should be illegal. If you guys want to do that, destroy yourselves, fine. But I am actually most grateful for laws that, make it harder for me to be exposed to that. I mean, as it is, I avoid whenever I can the outdoor areas where people are congregating and smoking, because outdoor or not, I mean, if I'm within 20 feet of one of those guys, I can feel it. And so I walk around, I'll go all the way around a building to avoid it. But, oh my God, like, how do people stand this? And recognizing that the percentage of smokers in society has been dropping, I'm actually even surprised that even absent any law, that the casinos wouldn't also prohibit smoking there too. But I guess it's considered part of the ambiance or whatever of such places. But I'm like, if their goal is to make it an enticing place where I go and continually give them money for no reason, and entice me with the noises of coins falling and fun stuff like that, If you make it a smoky environment, that's not helping. I'm out of there as quickly as I can. anyway, it was just shocking how much of a surprise it was, because at this point, like, the idea of having cigarette smoke in the environment inside is just so alien. I suppose there are places where you can still go for that, including these casinos. But I wasn't expecting it, and I was like, "Oh wow!" And then it was just a the whole time I was there, it was just like an omnipresent feature that was like demonstrably unpleasant. Anyway, I suppose I would feel different if I was a smoker. My wife is an ex-smoker. She hasn't smoked in since shortly after I met her 10 years ago, as far as I know. She used to smoke. So, her perceptions are different, I'm sure. And if you're an ongoing, continual smoker, I'm sure you don't find any problem whatsoever with it. As someone who has never smoked in my entire life, with the exception of one puff on one cigarette somebody tricked me into doing in my college years, no, awful stuff. Anyway, ISIS, the Middle East, well, Iraq particularly. The latest was, we had a big, I don't know what's the word, but a lot of reaction when ISIS or the Islamic State or ISIL or whatever we're calling them this week beheaded a photojournalist named, where's his name? I was looking at it like 10 seconds ago. Why'd it move? James Foley. And this got a lot of attention. The president spoke about it. There was a lot of stuff on Twitter. They posted the video of the beheading on YouTube, and it was all over Twitter. And I'll talk a little bit too about Twitter and YouTube's reaction to this. I did not click on the video. There have been a number of videos of this kind of thing over the years, and I have always chosen not to click on them. I generally am of the feeling that, especially when it's our own violence that's being perpetrated, we should see it, because we should, if we're going to decide that the right thing to do is to commit acts of violence, we should be able to look at those acts of violence with our eyes open and say that, yes, it's still worth it, even though this is what it looks like. But I didn't, I have never felt the need to this, to look at that, those kinds of, violent, explicit videos. Because I know, it would bother me deeply. And it would affect me deeply, and maybe it should, maybe it's worth doing that, to sort of feel the truth of the situation, as it were. But I think it also, you have to be very careful, because, it, once again, like we were talking about with Ferguson, it, I mean, makes you fixate on the specific case, as opposed to the, more general truth of what's going on. I guess we'll talk about this part of it first for now. Despite the fact that I have not watched it, I think it's actually important for it to be out there. YouTube removed the video after a while, although copies were, of course, out. Twitter started suspending accounts that had tweeted either the video or graphic pictures from the video. And apparently Twitter sometimes does this, at the requests of the families involved. And that appears like it might've been the situation here, but notice they did not remove, images of Michael Brown, from Ferguson, a lying dad. They also, while they suspended many accounts, for the James Foley pictures, they did not suspend the accounts of some major news organizations that tweeted links or pictures to it. So it's very unevenly implemented. And this is one area that I think Twitter is making a mistake. I understand that this content can be highly offensive. I understand that it can be highly disturbing. I understand that some people unexpectedly saw these pictures on their timelines because someone they followed posted the pictures, and now that Twitter doesn't just post text but actually posts, you know, you actually see the pictures in your timeline, kaboom, there it is. And I haven't, I didn't see any of the most graphic pictures this time around that way, but I did see graphic pictures of killed and injured people from Gaza that way. I've seen not safe for work pictures of a sexual nature also that way sometimes, which sucks when you're at work. But, you know, I understand that that's potentially a problem. And I think, you know, maybe you want to have mechanisms where people can, you know, go back to the old way of Twitter where it doesn't show the images unless you click on them. I would like that option anyway. But fundamentally, I think Twitter's making a mistake by outright just going out and removing these things, because I think there is value in having it out there and having the documentation and letting people decide on their own. Do they want to see these things? Do they want to look? And having it out there. And also, like I said, the uneven implementation is also a problem. You know, this was removed. The Ferguson pictures were not. The I can't remember how many graphic pictures I saw from Syria and Gaza when those things were going on. You know, some worse than others. So I just think it's a mistake for a company like Twitter to get into the business of making editorial decisions about what's okay and what's not okay on their platform. Now, I recognize they may be legally required in some cases where, you know, a government comes in and makes a rule that they have to follow, or illegal content or whatever. That's essentially the government making a rule you can't follow. I understand that. I think they should probably resist those laws where they can. But in general, getting into the business of making editorial decisions takes away from your value as a platform for people to communicate to each other. And I know Facebook's also making other moves. They're going to, you know, start highlighting things to you that you didn't necessarily subscribe to and things like that. I think that's a mistake too. They've provided a very strong presence as sort of a common carrier for people to broadcast their messages to the world and to the people who subscribe to them. Or follow them, I should use the right words. If they start fiddling around with that, they fundamentally change the nature of the platform. And I think it's a mistake. Now, they're going to measure that, of course, on, you know, what's the economic impact and, you know, advertisers and this and that and that. And as a public company, that's probably what they got to do. I still think it's a shame they're a public company. I think it would be awesome if Twitter was, you know, a nonprofit operated in the public interest. But, you know, that's not where we are. Now, notice one thing I have not said. I don't think... First of all, there's no First Amendment issue here. This is a private company. They have the right to do whatever they want with their platform. They can remove whatever accounts they want. They can censor whatever tweets they want. They can do all this. This is not the government coming in and mandating anything, which I think the government shouldn't do. It's perfectly within Twitter's rights to do whatever the hell they want with their platform. They could automatically translate every tweet into Pig Latin. They could arbitrarily remove anything that they don't like. They could do any of these things. I just don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it is a positive thing for Twitter to do. I think it makes it less attractive as a platform. But it's still their absolute right to do it. I just think they're making the wrong choice. Okay. Now back to the actual issues. We got a lot of attention because of this video. The president talked, all of this kind of stuff. But, and I should add, you know, we've also had quotes from people in the National Security Council and the Defense Department and State Department over the last few days since this video, talking about how evil ISIS is, how much of a threat they are, how much... we've had very strong statements about ISIS being just a huge threat that the entire West needs to take very seriously, and they are a threat to American interests everywhere, things along those lines. And I think this is remarkably unhelpful. First of all, I don't think it's remotely true. I think ISIS wants to have that kind of reach. I don't think they actually do yet. And even if they do, let's say in their wildest dreams, they approach the scale of Al-Qaeda, they accomplish a 9/11 scale attack. Let's say they accomplish several 9/11 scale attacks. I think we have to fight against the kind of overreaction we had after the first 9/11. 9/11 was not an existential threat to the United States. It was not an existential threat to the Western civilization. It was a horrific act of murder. It was a crime. Maybe you can extend and say, okay, let's call it a war. I think that's a mistake, but you know, I think of it as a mass murder. And these are bad. No questions about it. I mean, and it was a very traumatic event. But you need to put it in a larger context. Was the United States going to fall because of that? Was Al-Qaeda going to take over Western Europe and the United States and impose their values on our country? No. That was never in the cards. There was no threat along that scale. They killed a bunch of people. That's very bad. I'm not saying we should do nothing. in those scenarios. But we have to keep in perspective what the level of threat is. This was not on the scale of the threat posed to the world by the conflict between the United States and Soviet Union during the Cold War. It's not on the threat, the scale of the threat posed by, Hitler and Japan during World War II towards the areas that they were conquering and the peoples they were oppressing and killing. It's not that scale. Now, that's not to say ISIS are good guys. They're not. They're horrible. One of the things about this James Foley video is that all of a sudden it's getting a lot of attention because it's an American journalist. ISIS has been spending the last few months slaughtering lots and lots and lots of people. I'm not going to pretend to know the numbers. I've heard numbers in at least the tens of thousands, maybe higher. We heard about that group that was caught on the mountain. Many of them have escaped at this point. There's still somewhat of a crisis there, but it's better than it was. But before, you know, they headed to the mountain, tons of them were slaughtered. ISIS has been slaughtering people left and right who don't agree with them. They've been doing forced conversions. They have been killing anybody who got in their way. They have been incredibly brutal about it. Now, another thing I don't want to get into is this is particularly bad because they beheaded him versus if they'd shot him or done anything else to him to kill him. You know, in the end, yes, there's sort of a different visceral reaction depending on how someone is killed. But in the reality is, killing him is killing him is killing him is killing him. None of the ways that anybody is talking about killing these folks are painless, are stress-free. I suppose some of these shots may have been unsuspecting shots in the back of the head at point blank or something, which from, you know, what I understand is essentially instantaneous and you never know what happened because your brain doesn't have time to react. So, okay, there is a bit of a difference there. But in the end, you're killing them. You're killing them anyway. I mean, and yes, there have been reports of ISIS burying people alive, lots and lots of beheadings, some crucifixions, and, of course, shooting people, stabbing them, all the other kinds of things. But the bottom line is, in the end, all of these people are dead. They're killing people who have been fighting against them. They've been killing innocents. They've been killing whatever. This one guy suddenly gets the attention because he's American. And okay, great. We got some attention. Let's pay attention to these guys. It's frustrating that suddenly it matters because it's American. And I mean, I shouldn't say that entirely. We've been talking about ISIS for a while now, and we've been talking about some of their atrocities and some of the things they've been doing, and that they're bad guys. But there's a notion that seems to have been all over the place in this last week that suddenly it's more important because they killed an American. And that's just incredibly frustrating. Because no, yes, it's tragic that this journalist died. But it's tragic that those tens of thousands of other people died, too. And it's tragic that they're oppressing people and all of that. But, and here's where I always flip it around. This is being used as yet another excuse for people all over the political spectrum to be pounding on the table saying, we need to do something, we need to do something, we need to do something. And the Obama administration themselves are ratcheting up their rhetoric quite a bit in the last week about how much of a threat ISIS is. No question they're bad, but all kinds of people are arguing for increased intervention. We have to take them seriously. We have to obliterate them. We have to remove them from the planet. Some of the administration people are, doing a weird thing where they're talking about how evil they are and how much of a threat they are, but then they don't follow up with we need to destroy them. It's more about containment. I actually agree with the containment idea, but if you're gonna advocate for containment, you can't at the same time say, you know, they're the worst threat that's existed in the history of the Republic. Which which one of the a variety of people have said things similar to that. And as I retweeted something from Brendan Loy, who became popular on Twitter for his hurricane coverage during Katrina. Or I guess at that point it was a blog and then he moved, whatever. Anyway, and basically saying, no, look, the greatest threats to the American, the greatest threats in history to the American Republic were arguably one of two things, the Civil War or the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nothing else comes close. This doesn't come close. 9/11 doesn't come close. Get some perspective here. And in the we must do something perspective, again, my bottom line, and I know I'm a broken record, I know I'm a broken record on this, is can we actually make things better? And, you know, we've been doing airstrike after airstrike after airstrike. There have been special forces involved. Apparently, there were special forces trying to save James Foley from within Syria. It turned out they had the wrong place. He wasn't there. We've been doing all kinds of airstrikes. We're talking about escalation. We're arming the Kurds now. There's been talk today with administration officials being asked if they were going to be willing to go after ISIS in Syria, because a lot of people have been making the argument that you can't do any serious attack on ISIS with the goal of eliminating them anyway if you limit yourself to Iraq, because they're half in Syria, half in Iraq. And so administration officials have refused to rule that out. Of course, you know, refusing to rule things out is what folks do, and it's probably the right thing to do. You never want to sort of telegraph your options. But on the other hand, people are pushing to extend this war from Iraq, you know, first escalate the war in Iraq, then extend it into Syria. I have a really hard time believing that the end result of all that is in the end going to be less violence and less people dying. Because, you know, even if ISIS does their worst, I don't see that making it better. I see that being, you know, we're going to kill a bunch more people. We're going to make more enemies. We're going to perpetuate the cycle of violence. We're inserting weapons into a war zone. Guess what? That means they can fight longer. If we're serious about stopping this, the concentration should be on cutting off the flow of anything useful to the area, cut off weapons, cut off supplies, cut off anything but, you know, food and purely humanitarian things from the region that's controlled by this. Starve the situation. Don't feed it by, you know, adding more violence, adding more weapons. I am not convinced that that in any way makes it better. I've mentioned I'm becoming more and more of a pacifist as time goes on. You know, like, and if indeed you had a situation where you knew, okay, it was these, you know, 500, 1,000 people who are warped and doing violence and killing everybody, and we know they're violent, we know they're horrible, we know they're doing these things. Now, ideally, I'd like to capture them all and put them on trial and deal with it that way. But okay, maybe if you really truly had that detail of information and were able to surgically kill those folks and leave everybody else alone, maybe. But even then, first of all, I don't believe we have that level of detailed knowledge to do that in the right way. And second, we don't have the ability to implement that in a way that's not going to have unforeseen consequences. The unforeseen consequences part is what always comes up in these, you know, because more times than not, you're just going to make things worse. You can come in with the best motives possible and you want to fix this and you want to make it better and you want to do this and you want to do that. But then, you know, the reality hits and you don't have as good intelligence as you think you do and your implementation isn't as good as you think you do and all of these things. And you end up just, again, same analogy, throwing fuel on the fire. And we'll go back to the Ferguson example from the first half. It's the same kind of thing on a different scale. And there's a lot of argument that this is exactly what ISIS wants. They want us to jump in and overreach. Just like, I mean, fundamentally, this was Al-Qaeda's strategy, and we fell for it hook, line, and sinker. Because their goal was to get us sucked into the region. Their goal was also to get us out of Saudi Arabia, which we mostly got out of at that point. In any case, you know, like in Ferguson, the best way to defuse the situation and get to a resolution as quickly as possible may well be to ignore it and do nothing or do very little. You know, like I said, with regard to helping the people that were stuck on the mountain, if we can do limited things here and there that actually positively help people, then, okay, let's do that. And yeah, that maybe means also that we have a little bit more involvement. Like if we have, you know, a group that's been known for going into towns and, you know, slaughtering people, and we see them about to go into another town, and we can stop that through some strategic air strikes. Maybe that's what we need to do. But there's a very, 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 very dangerous slippery slope here. And so far, in the last couple weeks, I'm very worried because I see the Obama administration heading down that slope and escalating. And, you know, we've had a number of quotes in the follow-up to the James Foley killing with some very hot rhetoric about, you know, if you go after Americans, we'll get you wherever you are and things along those lines. And you're setting up one of two things. Either you're going to talk really tough and then not back it up with anything and look really stupid and hurt reputations and hurt, you know, and hurt how people see us in the world, or you're going to feel like you need to back up those statements and you're going to escalate and you're going to get us deeper and deeper into an intractable situation that we're not going to solve, and it's just going to result in more people dying on all sides and exacerbating the situation for years and years to come. And maybe the right answer is actually to cool down the rhetoric a little bit. You know, we can say the truth, say ISIS is bad, but don't try to blow it up into this huge, huge threat that is threatening the whole world. Maybe they will. They certainly sound like they have objectives to eventually do that, but they're not there today. And we shouldn't act like they are. And Alex is here. Alex, do you want me to help wrap up the show? I'm about ready to say goodbye. Anyway, I think that's going to be a show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Screech! See, at that exact point, Alex unplugged my microphone, and I got really mad at him and picked him up and took him downstairs and told him not to do that anymore and all that kind of stuff. I was probably a little harsher than I needed to be, but, you know, at the time I wasn't sure. I could have lost something, but anyway, he shouldn't unplug the microphone, especially when I'm inviting him to help say goodbye. Anyway, yeah, I was about to just say, you know, all the usual contact stuff. I should mention, too, like I said, Ukraine's going on, too. There additional developments and escalation going on there too that'll probably blow up to something we need to talk about again sooner rather than later. Israel Gaza is still going on. There was a ceasefire for a while, but now they're fighting again. And of course Syria, you know, people have complained that it hasn't gotten much attention lately, and it hasn't because it's been going on so long, but there's still people dying all the time in Syria, and of course ISIS is in Syria just as much as it is in Iraq. It's a mess. And hey, like I mentioned, today's Friday, August 22nd. Saturday, August 23rd is the season premiere of Doctor Who, New Doctor, 12th Doctor. My whole family is going to the midnight showing. It'll actually be on TV earlier than that, both in the UK and in the United States and here. I guess here is part of the United States, but we're not going to watch it on TV. We're going to go to a movie theater and watch it at midnight, and because that'll be fun, because there'll be geeky people dressed up and stuff. I don't have a costume to dress up in. The most I'll have is a t-shirt, but anyway, that should be fun. Any case, everybody, thanks for listening. As usual, you can reach me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com or look for me on Twitter at abelsmay. We like to hear your questions, comments, thoughts on everything. And of course, tell your friends. We like it when we get more people. I haven't looked at how many people are listening to this podcast in probably 6 months. I should probably do that sometime. Anyway, thanks. Hopefully Yvonne will be back with us next week. Have a good week, everybody. Goodbye.